I am Plot on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Tom Flanagan joins me again. He's just published a new book, Persona non grata, The Death of Free Speech in the Internet Age. It chronicles the fallout from what he calls the incident, the subsequent media firestorm, the denunciations he received from the Prime Minister's office through to the Premier and the leader of the opposition in Alberta, who he had advised in the previous provincial election campaign. On the 27th of February 2013, Professor Flanagan was giving a talk on the Indian Act when he was asked a question about child pornography. His response was recorded and posted online, resulting in a virtual mobbing that put him out of work and gave people who saw the clip the impression that, quote, Tom Flanagan was okay with child pornography. The book looks in detail as to the conditions to which this became a media melee and the resulting damage done to his reputation. The book is also highly readable and engaging when talking about the threat to academic freedom he suffered and the unpacking he does as to his views on child pornography, which a clip online couldn't possibly explain. Tom Flanagan is a professor of political science at the University of Calgary and a former advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper. He is a scholarly author and one of popular books that have won prizes, including the book he was on with last time some 7 years ago, Harper's Team, which I must say is one of the better books on politics in this country, especially in its insight into political campaigns, especially those campaigns of the last decade that brought Stephen Harper to the fore. This new book is a Signal book published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Tom Flanagan. Dr. Flanagan, good morning.
Hi, Joe. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So everyone by now knows what happened to you just over a year ago. After writing this book and reliving it again, sort of, and having to relive it again as you talk about this book throughout the country as you are, do you think you were naive?
I think I made a mistake in judgment. I didn't react to the circumstances. I had been invited down to talk about the Indian Act, speaking in a classroom on a university campus invited by a town and gown discussion society. When I got there, the audience was filled with hostile Idle No More activists who had come in from surrounding reserves. And I should have flipped the switch and gone from academic mode to political mode, but I didn't. I still continued to treat it as an academic event, and I tried to answer all questions that were asked, and that's what got me into trouble.
Do you think, though, that there is an academic mode, that there is a political mode, that's a hindrance to, say, political discourse in this country?
Yeah, it's a real problem for academics who get involved in politics, because academic speech and communication is fundamentally oriented towards finding out what's true and false. I mean, that's your responsibility as a scholar, to use established research methods and to publish your results and to accept criticism where warranted, and to try and refine your results and engage in discussion. All of that is the academic mode of speech. The political speech is not about true and false. Political speech is about building your coalition, bringing more supporters into your coalition. And so arguments about truth and falsity play a role in that, but that's actually probably a smaller role than arguments about the credibility of the source, what Aristotle called ethos, and also emotion, what Aristotle called pathos. So political argument is not fundamentally oriented towards determining what's true and false. So you can't do both at the same time, and if you try and live in both worlds, you have to do keep flipping the switch as you go from one to another, and if you forget to flip the switch, you can be in big trouble.
Hey, is this purely a Canadian phenomenon, that we can't talk about big issues like taxation, like immigration, like Senate reform, say, without being denounced as something?
Oh, no. This is a worldwide issue. For example, Larry Summers, former president of Harvard, one of the most powerful men in the world, had been Secretary of the Treasury to Bill Clinton. He'd been president of the World Bank. Then he went back to the university, became president of Harvard. That's the most important academic position in the world. He was brought down by some comments about the normal distribution and the implications of the normal distribution of human talents, and for the way that men and women might sort themselves out differently in finding jobs. You can read the scientific reports around that topic in all kinds of journals, but because of his political background, it was deemed unacceptable for him to say it. So here's a really famous person who got caught in the same kind of pincers that I did, like the intersection between the academic and the political.
Do you buy the premise that you got what you deserved? I mean, there's some people who think that that because you'd played hardball politics, especially on this issue of child pornography during the election campaign with Mr. Martin years ago, that you had this coming to you, perhaps.
Well, it is ironic, I guess. I mean, I personally hadn't done that. That regrettable episode in the 2004 campaign, where Paul Martin was accused of being soft on child pornography, was orchestrated by people in our communications group, and I wasn't involved in that. I learned about it afterwards, as did the leader, Mr. Harper. But yeah, I was manager of the campaign as a whole, and this was part of the whole team. So yeah, maybe it's poetic justice. What can I say?
Yeah. The other thing that I found interesting, because I mean, you are you have been a professor for 45 years or so, that you have your eye and your ear attuned to popular culture. I mean, there are references in this book that I found interesting to Glee, Seinfeld, Eagles lyrics, Tom Wolfe novels, The Music Man. Is this obviously a side of you that we're not familiar with, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would never be hired as a reviewer in the culture magazine of a mass newspaper, but yeah, I live in the world, and I go to movies and listen to music and read popular books. I mean, I also maybe spend some time reading Aristotle and stuff that most people wouldn't, but yeah, I am at least partially. I wouldn't say I'm hip. My kids would never say I'm hip, but I do. I would have had even what I wanted to do in the original draft. I wanted to include some lyrics from popular, particularly country and western songs, which is my music passion. Mm-hmm. But the publisher said, we can't do it. It's too expensive. I guess there are huge fees for repeating copyrighted lyrics. So that's why I refer to some of these things, but I don't actually quote them. I guess it's just over-the-top expensive.
Now, you write in the book about the people who... left your side, if you will, during this episode. Three in particular interest me: Daniel Smith and the Wild Rose Party, of course, the Prime Minister's office, and the CBC. Of the three, was the CBC the one that hurt the most?
No, emotionally it would have been Daniel Smith. You know, she is a former student. I thought we had a close relationship. I had just finished managing. Well, it wasn't. It was about a year ago, but I had managed her provincial campaign. She had asked me to. I had helped her build the team, and then I stepped in to manage it when the first choice as manager wasn't available anymore. And so I thought we were friends, and then she treated me like that. So that was emotionally the hardest to take. With the PMO, I actually had not had any relationship with Stephen Harper ever since the publication of Harper's Team. Mm-hmm. He never got over that. So I was persona non grata with him since, when did that book come out? Maybe 2007.
Yeah.
CBC, I was surprised, but this came, after I'd already been fired by several other organizations. So, I was just more, I would say more astonished than anything else. But I do think the CBC has a lot to answer for, because this is the biggest news gathering organization in the country, and surely they can do better than react to a YouTube posting without doing any further research.
Am I drawing too fine a line to the way that the CBC handled you and how the minister in charge at the time, the Heritage Minister James Moore, applauded your ouster there? I mean, he was even calling for your university, the University of Calgary, to fire you. Is there a too close a connection between those two events?
Well, I doubt they were connected. I don't think they were connected in any direct way. The CBC abrogated the contract with me, I think, before James Moore made his statement. I'd be surprised if he was leaning on the CBC. But it is, you know, it is food for thought, isn't it, that the CBC would rush to take a position which seems to be so aligned with the government of the day. All I can say is that thank God for we have a pluralistic media environment ranging from huge government-funded organizations like the CBC through the privately owned media down to the sort of boutique media like yourself. I mean, there are so many different outlets that it's hard to keep somebody from getting his story out if he's really interested in telling it. And I think that's really crucial to a free society, that we have this kind of pluralistic media.
And while you were treated badly by, say, some privately owned media like the Sun papers, other public broadcasters like TVO were able to provide you with a space to speak out, right, after all of this?
Yeah, Steve Paikin at TVO agreed to have me on to do an interview. So that's sort of an exception. But it's an interesting fact that the stoning, for the most part, was led by the public sector. It was politicians, you know, people in government, people in political parties, publicly owned media, publicly owned institutions like universities, a publicly supported think tank, at least partially publicly supported, like the IRPP. Organizations that are genuinely private, like think tanks, like the Fraser Institute here in Vancouver, or privately owned media like the National Post, Globe and Mail, and Maclean's, they were the ones that gave me an opportunity to tell my side of the story, and they were the ones that did not join the stampede. It was, by and large, the public sector that orchestrated the whole stampede.
Yeah. Now, back to Danielle Smith for just a minute and how she acted in your situation. Does that reflect, you think, on her abilities to govern? I mean, would you endorse her in a forthcoming election, say?
Well, I'm not going to go out and endorse her. I mean, she has, you know, she said in categorical terms, I would never have anything to do with the Wild Rose Party again. I might make some comments about election or campaign if the media would ask me, but as far as her fitness goes, well, I regard it as a sad mistake. All I can say is if she continues to treat people that way, she's going to find it difficult to recruit people who have any reputation to help her. I mean, who with an established reputation would go to work for her if you can expect to be treated like that?
Now, the stuff in the book about Stephen Harper has gotten a lot of notice in the press since the book's come out, even before the book's come out. The stuff that Mr. Harper has an almost Nixonian side to him, that he's prone to depression. Was that payback for him throwing you under the bus?
Well, I had to say these things in order to tell the story I was telling. Otherwise, it's difficult to understand why the PMO would have gone after me in such extravagant language. Those psychodynamics in the background. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. I think the same thing is true with the way that he's treated the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Nobody can see any positive strategic value in what he's doing. It's hard to explain except in terms of a fit of pique after having lost several big decisions. So he's a complicated man, like Nick. I compared him to Nixon. Conrad Black said it was unfair to Nixon, but I compared him to Nixon. But remember, Nixon was the most intelligent president of modern times in the United States, and very effective in many ways. Nixon accomplished a great deal as president, but he had this more difficult side, which eventually led to his undoing, and that's the sad thing about Stephen Harper. He's a brilliant man, and he's accomplished a great deal, but he does have this more difficult side, which sometimes gets him in trouble, and we continue to see evidence of it.
Yeah, I visited the Nixon Library last week, so I would take Conrad's assessment of that was negative to Richard Nixon. But back to these mindless fights with the Chief Justice and before that Elections Canada. I get the sense that this sort of behavior worried you a long time ago. So what is happening there now? Is he getting bad advice, or is he not getting any advice and acting on his own, do you think?
Well, I saw some evidence along these lines years ago. I worked closely with him for about 5 years, and I saw some episodes of that type, but they weren't generally publicly known. Mm-hmm. And they gave me cause for concern, but I kept thinking that, well, you know, he's in political terms, still learning, and that this will go away. And then when he did come to power, there was a phase when the conservative, and we had started this before coming to power, to deliberately trying to broaden out the team and bring in people of some degree of eminence from academia or business or the professions, different parts of the country and so forth, trying to build a stronger team around the prime minister. So I felt, as long as this was happening, that the presence of people like that would contain these tendencies. But you know what? Unfortunately, it hasn't worked that way, and now the team is shrinking. All the well-known people have left, or, you know, under various circumstances. Some, like Nigel Wright, were thrown under the bus. Others just chose to depart, like David Emerson. Each one's a different story, but mm-hmm. the reality is now that the team around the prime minister doesn't contain many people whose names would be recognizable, and so I think there's less than ever of a restraint around these dark moods.
So how do you see this playing out? How do you see the Harper narrative ending? I mean, are we at the end, do you think? I mean, this is 8 years.
Oh, no, not necessarily. I think we're in for a very interesting election. I wouldn't begin to predict who might win, but the conservative base still seems to be strong behind the leader. You know, there seems to be a core vote of just slightly under 30%. 27-28%, something like that, which is not enough to win, but it's enough to keep you going in a multi-party race. So he just has to get back some people that probably voted conservative in the past but have been turned off by this whole series of things that have happened. The conservatives have, you know, they have some pretty good stories to tell, balancing the budget, negotiating free trade agreements, prospect of tax cuts, cutting back on the civil service in Ottawa, chipping away at pensions and perks, things like that. They've got a lot of good stories. So if they can just get the focus on the stories that work for them, and stop getting involved in these pointless squabbles with other officials, I think that they still would have a chance to win in the next election. But at the same time, I think Justin has proved to be a formidable leader for the time being. He doesn't seem deep at all, but I mean, he's done everything a leader needs to do. He's brought up the Liberals' polling numbers. He's rebuilt their fundraising apparatus. He's recruited some, what shall we call them, star candidates, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, up to this point, it's working for them, so I think it's going to be a really interesting election, and I wouldn't begin to say who's going to win, but I'm in no way writing off the conservatives.
Now, what the book Persona Non Grata provides is a valuable lesson in terms of where we are with free speech in the internet age. I mean, that's the subtitle of the book. I mean, you mm-hmm. talk in the book about this lynch mob mentality, and it's heightened by the media, by the internet culture. So how do we as citizens gird ourselves against jumping to conclusions as to a man's reputation, as you've obviously experienced?
Yeah. Well, I don't have any magic answers. A couple of things that would help. First of all, I think the mainstream media should take their responsibilities more seriously and not generate huge national stories based on simply on things like a YouTube posting or a pirated telephone conversation. I mean, what's in the news this last week has been the case of Donald Sterling in the United States. Seems to have said some very offensive things, but this was a private phone conversation which was released. We still don't know who. Mm-hmm. V. Stiviano, her lawyer, claims that she didn't do it. It's hard to make sense out of the whole thing, and yet there was this huge rush to judgment. Now, Sterling is a very wealthy and powerful man. He's got the money to fight back legally. I don't know what will happen. So anyway, the mainstream media, I think, have to be aware of their responsibility in dealing with stuff that comes out of nowhere on social media. People at large, I think, need to become more skeptical. People at large have to realize that a recording of a phone conversation or a video recording is not ipso facto evidence of what actually happened. That these types of recordings can be edited. Even if they're not edited, they're almost always taken out of context. They're almost always pieces of some larger recording. It makes a huge difference what that context is. How did these events come to happen? Was somebody lured or baited into doing something? Until you have answers like that, you really should not rush to judgment. So we have now this speeded up news cycle in which there's so much emphasis on being first, not right, but first, and these nuances to get lost. Now, I think that's actually something I have absolutely no answer for, is the effect of the speed up of the 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah.
This is what kills research and fact-checking.
Yeah.
Media outlets feel they've got to get something out there. They see their competitors posting, and now nobody, really broadcast and printing are kind of obsolete. Everything is now done by posting to a website. Maybe it gets broadcast later in the day on a TV, or it gets printed the next day in a newspaper, but the news is made when a radio station or a TV station or a newspaper or a magazine puts something up on its website. So this has accelerated the competition. I mean, in one sense, that's great. That's highly competitive, and we're finding out things that we otherwise never would. But it's kind of like a golden age of news coverage. But there's a potential threat there when the emphasis on being first overcomes the desire to get it right. Now, how you deal with that, I don't know. I mean, the people in the media are going to have to sort that out. I can see the damage, but I have no idea how to fix it.
Finally, Professor Flanagan, you're a poli-sci professor, so can you explain federalism to me and my audience? You actually do it in the book in a terrific way. There's a joke about elephants.
Yeah, well, that's the best explanation I've ever seen. So picture an international boarding school with several, the teacher assigns the project to write an essay on elephants. And the French boy comes back with an essay entitled Les Amours des Elephants. And the German boy has an essay on an introduction to the life of the elephant in a short introduction in four volumes. And the American boy writes an essay entitled How to Build Bigger and Better Elephants. Canadian boy says, elephants, a federal or provincial responsibility, ? So anyway, I always tell that joke in my introductory classes, and then I move on to another topic because I'm not that interested in federalism, really.
Yeah, it's a great joke.
It's a great
line, yeah. Well, good luck with this book, Tom. I hope a lot of people read it because there's a lot of stuff in this book that's worth pondering. Thanks for this.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
The book is called Persona Non Grata, The Death of Free Speech in the Internet Age. It's from Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Its author, Tom Flanagan, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.